Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you all for coming. I'm Paul Westland, helping coordinate these sessions with the new Christian Action Group here at St. Paul. I'm going to get started a minute or two early with some announcements so that David can get started right at 10 after. First of all, a couple of things I wanted to mention. One is thanks to everybody who came out. And Friday night, at a session here, we had a hugely pleasant evening with the movie presentation of the movie Call of the Forest about the importance of trees in general and climate change in particular. And we had, I think we had a count of 180 people here Friday night. So thanks to everybody for showing up and making that successful. I also wanted to note we've got a lot of things to do in a short time at these sessions. And for those of you who were here last week, no, there wasn't a whole lot of time for questions, but we don't want to make this, totally talking at you. So one of our efforts was there's index cards on the tables and the chairs. If you want to have a comment or question, anything related to these general conference issues at all, please fill them out and leave them there or get them to me or Sarah Farabee afterwards. We'll even take a look at posting those on the church website, the questions and answers. Also, for those of you who might know who missed last week or might know somebody or want to listen again, a recording of these sessions will be on the website. Last week's session is up there on the church website now. So we want to make those available to as many people as possible on these important topics. The final thing before I just turn it over to David is that I want to encourage you to think of especially this week's presentation and next week's presentation really as one presentation. This week's is going to be on the proposal to go before the General Conference. It's really gotten a lot of press in the last couple of weeks. A lot of you probably have seen it in different newspapers and broadcast. But there are also, even before that came out, there are four other proposals that we'll be talking about next week, and David Green will be presenting those. We worked very hard to get two people named David doing those, and so I think we've got good session planned there, although, the protocol has a lot of merits to it and a lot of support. It's also not at all a done deal. Who knows what could happen between now and May, and that's what David's going to be talking about today. The final thing, my main job here is to be the time cop, so I'll be standing up and waving my arms at David with 5 minutes before we adjourn, and then we will adjourn at promptly at 10:45 so people can get where they need to go. David?
Sure. Well, hello again.
Hello.
We did this, just last week, maybe?
Yeah.
But I'm glad to be back with you and thankful for the conversations that we started last week and the questions and emails that followed, and excited to kind of be with you again as we talk about another phase in this thing we call our United Methodist Church. As Paul alluded to, there's lots happening, a lot of things out there, and today we'll pick up just one kind of piece of that, and particularly we'll pick up what we've come to know or come to call anyways as the protocol. The full name of this is the Protocol for Reconciliation and Grace Through Separation. And you can imagine that's a mouthful, so we will talk about that in terms of the protocol. But a couple of things just to remind you, and I've added a few words here, of things that we can accomplish and then some things that we cannot necessarily accomplish in these 45 minutes or even over the next couple of Sundays in those sessions. I have added here something that says that things will change. And so I want you to hear that. I'm going to say that. If you thought that there were muddy waters last week, what we'll talk about today simply kind of muddies them further. We'll talk about some specifics that are in place, but at the same time, we'll acknowledge that these can change. They can change in the grand scope, and they can change in specifics as well. So we'll continue to try to frame the questions that best we can. We'll try to provide some information around what is this protocol, but I'll caution you that, again, it can change and likely will. I won't go through these slides in detail, but just a reminder that of the current language that exists around sexuality in the current Book of Discipline, along with the current discipline's definition of marriage and its position on whether or not churches can conduct same-sex ceremonies in their buildings, and then also the intersection between sexuality and ordination. And again, currently the United Methodist Church does not allow self-avowed homosexuals to be appointed as clergy, nor can clergy conduct those ceremonies. Again, to remind you, and we'll get into the specifics here in just a moment, we are talking about sexuality, but we're also, to be fair to everyone involved, we're also talking about their interpretation of Scripture or their understanding of accountability, again, definition of marriage. There's a whole host of things that are at play, and again, we'll start to put, as we talk about the protocol, start to put some specifics to that. And then also, as we talk about the protocol, this list of what could be called extemporaneous or miscellaneous details actually come to the forefront when we talk about this protocol. And so again, I hope you hear that, yes, this is about sexuality, it's about ordination, it's about weddings, it's about marriage. But as we get into the protocol, these things about money and pensions and hospitals, all of these things get brought to the fore when you start to talk about the actual plan that we call a protocol. And so what is that? We shared last week that that since February of 2019, when the traditional conference or traditionalist plan was passed at General Conference, there have been a variety of other plans that have been introduced. I think I shared last week that the traditional plan that is in effect really tightens some of the accountability and tightens some of the penalties and tightens some of the language around that existing stance that the Methodist Church has around sexuality. But as you have experienced, or as you know, not everyone was thrilled with their traditional plan. And also, the way that we as a church went about even having the conversation was not healthy and was not fruitful, and in many ways caused a lot of harm. And so it was out of both the details of the traditionalist plan passing and also the way that it was passed and the ongoing tension amongst persons in our churches. There have been a variety of plans that have been brought forth since February. And as Paul said, and as David will speak about next week, there's a whole group of plans that have all been named, things like the Indianapolis plan, the New Expressions, the Next Generation. These plans are out there. These plans are available for people to view. I listed in parentheses really the group that's behind each of those other plans. And so those have been out there. They've been worked on. They have been crafted into legislation. And then the protocol was released. And the protocol was released on January the 3rd, and we will get into some of that. And you may have been paying attention to the news, or you may have seen it cross your news feed, but the protocol itself, in a way that none of the other plans generated, the protocol itself generated a lot of news. And so I captured and pulled just a few of the headlines from some of the leading news outlets. And so the Washington Post and the Times, the Wall Street Journal, and then the Courier put this out there. And it highlights, I think, one of the differences between all of the other plans and the protocol. The other plans have been done, in a sense, by the separate groups that were listed. The other plans have been crafted and honed, and they've been presented before. In fact, they're kind of back. None of them captured the attention of the media, and none of them had the same kind of weight, both in terms of substance and in terms of people, that the protocol has. And so for that reason, when the protocol was released, it got picked up in significant ways and has then been thrust really to the forefront of the conversation. Who is behind this protocol then? Who has been garnering all of this attention, and why has it done so? In ways that the other plans have not, the protocol brought to the table a variety of groups. In fact, it was convened and called by one of the African bishops, which gives it, in a sense, a non-U.S. centric origin. And for a worldwide church that is as strong in Africa as it is, the fact that an African bishop would convene such a group holds a lot of weight and provides a lot of sway. There were also jurisdictional bishops, and so bishops within the United States were a part of it. And then very intentionally and with great deliberation, the convening group invited to the mediation table representatives from three broad categories of United Methodist. And I think we all might acknowledge that sometimes the labels of traditionalist, centrist, and progressives is not always helpful, but it is the way that we tend to talk about this and the way we tend to try to identify this. But the mediation group brought together representatives from these three these three buckets of persons, representing the various caucus groups that I listed there to the right. And so you may have heard in the past of groups like the Wesleyan Covenant Association, or in the centrist bucket, you may have heard of organizing Methodist groups like UMC Next, or Mainstream USA, or UMC, or in the progressive bucket, Reconciling Ministries. The mediation group sought to bring representatives from those areas to the table to have the conversation. In total, there were about 16 persons there. In addition to the mediator and other outer circle groups. And so the group, while it may not have had financial expertise among the buckets, there were other groups that were brought in to speak to the financial implications, some of which we'll share here in a minute. But the other thing that sets this mediation group apart from other groups doing plans, again, the collaboration amongst these, but also the use of a mediator. And you have probably heard, if you have followed it at all, that there was a mediator who worked with the group essentially to keep them at the table. Mr. Feinberg is a Jewish, of the Jewish faith, but has deep interest in religion and the public space. And so he offered his services and those of his team to keep this group together and to help them work through the different challenges that they faced. And the mediator, Mr. Feinberg, he is famous in the United States context for being a mediator and an administrator of things like the Victims Fund for 9/11, also for the BP Gulf disaster. He worked also, I believe, with the victims of the Boston Marathon bombing. He's got a broad appeal, but also a deep experience base. And so he brought all of those skills, coupled with his desire to see religion flourish in the public landscape, and set at the table to guide the process. They met over various sessions, 2-day sessions, in fact, several times, and then again achieved a protocol and then released it to the public just a few weeks ago. But then you might wonder, well, what is this protocol? In its essence, it's a 9-page document that outlines the agreements that the mediation group was able to come to. It specifically calls for 2 or more denominations in the Methodist tradition. It then, in helping to give shape to what 2 or more denominations would look like, it outlines the processes for central conferences or annual conferences or local churches to choose which of those new denominations that they would wish to affiliate with. When it comes to money, again, one of the things that sets the protocol apart from the other plans you'll hear about next week, the protocol is one of the first that actually puts dollars to paper for the plan itself. Some of the other plans, they have different components of the protocol, or you might say vice versa. The protocol has components of those prior plans. But the protocol is the first to try to put some dollars to paper to see what that might actually look like should there be some separation in the United Methodist Church. And so what was agreed upon was $25 million to be paid by the General Council on Finance. That organization, we have a finance committee here at St. Paul. The annual conference has a finance committee. The jurisdiction has finance committees. This is the global finance committee, excuse me, of the United Methodist Church. They agreed in the protocol to set aside $25 million for a new traditionalist denomination. They agreed to escrow or put aside $2 million for any other denominations that might form out of this separation. And then they have set aside and have committed $39 million, as they put it, to support communities historically marginalized by the sin of racism. And the commitment there is one of acknowledging that when organizations split or when significant decisions like this are made, either organizationally or financially, it's oftentimes the marginalized who get left out. Or it's the marginalized who bear the weight of decisions made by, let's just put it, people that look like us or me. And so there's a commitment there for African-American and other ethnic ministries to be supported through the transition. Let me pause to say, it's not on a slide, but the question comes also, what would these denominations look like? That are formed. And in that space, there's a lot of questions. It is pretty clear that the traditionalist denomination that would wish to be formed would look something like a denomination that maintains our current disciplinary language, which is then the prohibition against homosexual clergy and local churches performing or celebrating same-sex weddings in their space. The denomination then that might remain, which we would call maybe the post-separation United Methodist Church, there's some differing thoughts on what that would look like. And in fact, it's not been decided. There are some who would hope that the post-separation United Methodist Church would abolish all of its current disciplinary language around prohibitions, again, around ordination and same-sex marriage. There are some, however, that would wonder if the post-separation UMC wouldn't abolish and totally endorse from top to bottom new disciplinary language. There's some that imagine that the post-separation UMC would allow, in a sense, a local option so that there could be a mixed bag of churches in that new denomination. churches who may be more traditional and some who may be more progressive. And so, the makeup and the nature and the exact practices of that post-separation aren't entirely clear in the way that they seem to be pretty clear for the traditionalist denomination. You might wonder, how does this thing happen? How does the protocol come to be? It'll be taken up in some form or fashion at General Conference, which we talked about last week. It'll be taken up there in May. There have been some dates set out and such that if the protocol were to pass, there would be a request of that new denomination to register their intent to form that denomination by May 15th. And that would then initiate a process by which, again, central conferences, churches, annual conferences, they can take up the work of deciding which of the bodies or which of the denominations they would want to most affiliate.
And the slide says May 15th, 2021.
That's correct. That's correct. You have a year. For central conferences, again, if this is adopted, and central conferences are those conferences outside of the United States, they would be given a separate timeline by which they would vote and take action around which denomination they would affiliate with. And you'll see here that it would require a two-thirds vote by any one central conference with which direction it would affiliate. For annual conferences, and so those smaller bodies, of which we have 55 in the United States and Kentucky is one, there's a little bit different process that we would undertake here to decide where we might affiliate. The first thing that's required is a 20% vote of our annual conference. And again, that's the body that meets every June. By July 1st of 21, we would have to reach a 20% threshold on whether we would want to have the actual vote about disaffiliating or going with a new denomination. And so you can think of that initial vote as, well, it's the vote to vote. Requires a 20% to pass. If it passes and if then we as an annual conference decide to vote on which denomination we would affiliate with, a 57% vote is required. A quick word about 57%. The mediation group has been pretty clear that was one of the strongest points of disagreement or give and take. There were many persons that wanted that annual conference vote to be a simple majority. But there were also then many who wanted the annual conference vote to be two-thirds. And I'd like to take a guess at where 57% falls between 50 and 66. And it probably gives me an opening to say, too, I think all of the persons participating in that mediation group would acknowledge that there was a lot of give and take, that no one group got everything they wanted. And I can't speak for them, though I think I've heard them say it. These voting thresholds, along with the one I'll show you in a minute, were absolutely the product of significant compromise by the two groups. At the local church level, again, we've talked central and annual conference. To take it to the local church level, there is places in the protocol for local churches to affiliate in ways that are different than what their larger annual conference might decide. The question then comes, how does a local church do that? And again, I mentioned compromise. Part of how local churches would vote and how that process would play out, again, as currently described, though subject to change, the local church council or administrative board would be in charge of setting for that local church its voting threshold. The options available then to the church board for setting the threshold are a simple majority or a two-thirds vote. And so then the local church would engage in its process of voting, and by doing so, deciding which denomination it would affiliate with. Here are a few more details about the local church side of this. There's some timeline, there's some expediency, but then also some grace extended for local churches to not make a decision until much later, when perhaps some of the dust has been settled on exactly what these new denominations will take shape and how they will look. The question in our Methodist circles is oftentimes too around property and the trust clause, which in our Methodist world, church property that local churches hold, both physical, tangible, intangible, all of those properties, all of those assets are held in trust of the United Methodist Church. And so currently, when churches want to leave the denomination, church congregations can do that, but we, the annual conference, we keep the buildings, we keep the assets, we keep those things that a local church may have. That's been one of the deterrents from churches leaving the denomination, and there are other good reasons why that's in place. But the protocol would release and relax all trust clause and all trust clause claims, such that if a local church wished to leave the United Methodist Church to affiliate with a different denomination, we, the conference in the United Methodist Church, would forego the trust clause, and the local church would be able to take all of its properties with them. Again, this is a significant piece and really goes at the fabric, goes to the core of what has been a part of the connectional DNA of our church to this point. So it's significant. The other question that gets asked often is around pensions. Our General Board of Pensions, they have around $26 billion under management. It is a massive pension plan for clergy and laity. And so it's been at the core of this discussion. What happens if separation comes to our church? What happens to pensions? And the idea is that the pensions would remain with the persons, but that the annual conference obligation to fund and fulfill those pensions would move to go to the denomination where those persons or churches are located. Again, as the person responsible for our conference's Board of Pensions and the pension balance sheet and fulfilling obligations, the fact that we could send pension liability elsewhere and not retain it, though we might lose churches, that's a fairly big deal to us. Finally, a few other key dates that I listed here. General Conference, our Kentucky Annual Conference. I put in italics. The annual conference will meet again in June of 2021. That's our annual meeting. We have tentatively scheduled an annual conference gathering this December in the event that we have to take up or vote on things that come out of General Conference, things that we may not be ready to vote on in June, 2 weeks later. We've scheduled a time in December, possibly, to take up votes if need be. Then finally, I've listed a couple of the other dates that are included here in the protocol. With that, I'll hush and leave you with a time for some Q&A and acknowledge to you that there are tons of questions in this. I think there are a lot of cautions that need to be lifted up as part of this. The reactions to the protocol in the past 2 to 3 weeks, the reactions have been varied. We can talk about those. But there are some other resources that I'll try to mention before we break. So, Pam?
You listed three numbers, the $25 million, $2 million, $39 million.
Yes.
I understand those. The number you didn't list is how much does the church that remains
have?
in comparison to those? Because I find that it's often useful to me to follow the money, to figure out how something's working.
No, you're fine. I understand that.
Repeat the question, David.
So Pam's question related, I'm going to scroll back, Pam, to the money. I recall a mentor friend of mine who said the answer to all of life's questions is money. And, like, I can quibble with that, or we could quibble with that, but we also know there's a lot of truth in that. So these are the amounts. Pam asked, you know, how much are these in comparison maybe to the assets that currently exist from which these would be pulled? And trying to think, so quadrennially, so every 4 years, the Methodist Church, we work in four-year buckets, and you'll hear us talk about quadrennia. The quadrennial budget for GCFA, so the current budget for GCFA to carry on all of its ministries as they currently exist today, that quadrennial budget is about $600 million. I anticipate that's going to go down substantially, partly just because of the changing nature of charitable giving and the changing landscape of the United Methodist Church. But that's the budget that's required for us to carry on the church life over a four-year period. To speak to what assets exist in full on the balance sheet, I don't know necessarily, Pam, the answer to that.
The reason that, you know, knowing that number is relevant to me is the assumption of these numbers then based on assumptions or thoughts,
yeah,
or predictions as to how many churches are going to remain versus how many churches are going to leave.
Yeah. So Pam's question, and if I can just, yep, is how did these numbers come to be? And my quick answer is I don't know the ins and outs specifically. Could it have been that $25 million represents a projection of the number of churches that might want to go form a new denomination? I think that's possible. I think that the mediation team could have done some forecasting. The caution there is that's tough. And what we tried to do that at the annual conference level to figure out what happens if 10% of our churches leave, or what happens if these 25 churches don't pay their fair share of ministry cost. And as good as I think we are at projecting at least budget numbers, you know, 30% of the time my assumptions about churches and how they might act have been totally wrong. And so I'm thankful that we get it right some, but my point being, I think it'd be very tough, and this may represent a best effort, but I'm not sure anybody knows how many churches and or clergy would actually leave.
But that amount would only go to that denomination. It's not per
25
friends per anything,
yeah,
like that.
The $25 million would be for the singular traditionalist denomination that might exist.
Yeah. 5 minutes for a few more questions and summing up.
Brian?
Yeah, on the, just to kind of follow what Pam was talking about, this is the protocol that's going to be presented as one of the six plans.
Yes.
But things will be amended.
Yes.
So can we also assume that when they get to the May, this will all be looked at, those numbers might be amended.
Yeah.
Do you think that as of May, I understand that the timelines that you've done on other slides, that, you know, pushes it on out to 2021 and beyond even. Do you think that after the May meeting, in terms of forecasting, people might have a better idea so that those numbers after May might reflect a more...
So Brad's question is around the timeline and forecasting. And let me say two things to that. One, this, the nine-page document, the financial numbers, the voting thresholds, the timelines, all of that will go to General Conference, where they could accept it as is or slice and dice it and change every part of it. So it is subject to change. The one thing that I will lift up that I had not yet included is that the 16 signers to the protocol representing the various groups have all made a public commitment to take the protocol back to their constituencies and to support it and only it.
After it's amended, or if it's amended.
As, it's not amended.
As it is. And so I think it does put it in a slightly, it gives it a slightly different position and dynamic and clout than some of the other plans. Do they have enough of all of those things to prevent alteration? I don't know. Do they have enough of those things to get it passed? I don't know.
In light of that statement about having support from the 16 members of
right. That
group, your other list of other proposals seem to come from a lot of those 16 groups.
Right.
Does that mean they're going to abandon those in favor of the protocol or not?
I think when I give voice to reactions to the protocol, the reactions are varied. Meaning, I think a lot of these groups, I think a lot of these groups will get in line with the protocol, but I don't think it's 100%. I think there are some in these groups who maybe weren't so interested in as much compromise as the protocol seems to give. Or I think there are probably some in this group who, hey, they're thankful for the leaders of their groups that were at the table, but they feel like something was unsaid. I think the reaction, again, has been both endorsement, skepticism, challenge. I think the reaction is broad to the protocol. And so I think there's possibility that something out of the Indianapolis plan, just to name one, somebody could say, we really like that particular piece of the Indianapolis plan. Is it workable or possible to get it into the protocol? That's possible. I think that's possible.
Maybe another question or a summary.
All right.
How are delegates chosen? How many delegates will meet in May?
The delegates to May, that would be equal clergy, equal laity, roughly, I just call it 900 delegates, so 450 of each. And they represent the different annual conferences and central conferences based upon that conference's size. So Kentucky has, based upon our membership and size, we have 5 clergy, 5 laity. They were elected this past June at our annual conference. We have a very representative, democratic, small d process for doing that.
Thank you.
Final thing?
Yeah,
right. The final thing would simply be this. I throw in the protocol at you with all of its numbers and variations and money, property, churches. There's a lot there. And while it's impossible to predict whether or not it passes, and while it's impossible to predict what form it might take or what parameters might pass, I can cynically say, as we've seen at other general conferences, hey, nothing's going to happen. But I will say this time, and I think change is coming to our church. And whether it happens by the protocol and whether it happens in some orderly, agreed-upon process or whether it happens by one of these other groups taking action outside of General Conference, I think change is coming. I think change is coming. Again, we don't know all the details. We don't know exactly all the shapes that it will take. I think this represents some good work that has been done by some committed persons. but it's not crystal clear either. How's that for a closing?
Chicken. Thank you, David. As I mentioned, next week we're going to talk about the four other protocols, proposals. And I know for certain not all the questions got asked, so please use the cards. We will capture those and look for responses. Also, on the cards, and I mentioned this last week, if you're interested in other times and maybe times when there might be more time for discussion and explanation of some of these proposals, put that on the cards if you have an interest in that as well. When we met and talked about this, we talked about maybe should there be a Sunday afternoon session? Should there, you know, some evening of the week? Are there times when there might be the interest for people to come where there would be more of a chance for discussion and questions about some of these? So with that, thank you and enjoy the rest of your day and see you next week.